Good evening, James McCann here with my Science Hour for April 15, 2021, and many topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about the volcano at St. Vincent. Poor people down there fleeing the island, being carried away, and being caught in the middle of a conflict of interest. The cruise ships have been sending big ships there. Of course, they can hold 7,000 people, some of them more. They have to evacuate like 40,000 people. That's not a small task. But when they get on the cruise ships, they come over to another island to be let off, and then some local official is telling them, you can't get off a cruise ship here. And, you know, it's like, this is like a half an hour ride across, and, you know, there's something like 30 islands in the chain. It's called the Grenadines down in the Caribbean, the southeastern Caribbean island of St. Vincent is where the actual volcano is, called Le Soufriere. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's like a French word. But I'm not sure if these people will be able to move back there. There were a number of volcanoes in the Caribbean, Montserrat, but going back in history, there have been major volcanic eruptions down in the Caribbean in these islands, and with very devastating results. So as far as I know right now, nobody has been injured or died in this volcano. But, of course, ash falling and the local trade winds, interestingly enough, are typically from the east. But from what I understood, the trade winds have switched and are blowing the plume, which is like 20,000 feet high, off to the east. Now, I can't confirm that. That's just something I read. And I've seen pictures of this. It's a rather narrow caldera. The caldera is not very big, but the column, 20,000 feet high, and I bet there's some very nice lightning going on in that baby at night, visible at night, happening all the time. But anyway, these poor people are being caught in the middle of this physical disaster, and then couple that with political disaster that's going on at the same time. Over the last weeks, I've been talking about the issue of Moses taking the Israelites out of Egypt, the famous story, and of course, crossing the Red Sea, and then marching around the desert for 40 years with the promise of the land flowing with milk and honey. And of course, that whole issue, I've gotten a lot of comments in. This one interesting issue was a guy who worked in a dairy, and he said there was a certain day of the month when they would call it Jewish Milk Day. That's what they actually called it in the dairy. When the Jewish people would come and they had to have the entire place cleaned specifically for their needs, and the milk that they purchased, which I later found out from another source, was lactose-free milk. They had to have lactose-free milk, and that's what they took back because, it had to be kosher. But apart from being kosher, which is a cleansing issue, making sure the food is clean, they had to have the lactose removed, which supports the concept that I was talking about last week, that why would you, the issue of the Jews taking over the place of the Israelites, claiming the history of the Israelites as being coming out with Moses out of Egypt, and the point being that if you had high lactose intolerance, like 100% in your population, you would hardly be wishing for a land flowing with milk and honey, because it would be like poison. This is long before they understood what lactose tolerance was or was not. And by the way, it is also a genetic thing. It's something you can look at the genetics of the person and understand if they are lactose tolerant or intolerant. It has to do with the ability of the digestive system to break down lactose, which is a very big sugar molecule, into smaller sugars that are then digestible by the body. So that's what lactose intolerance is all about. And lactose, the way to remove that from milk is with something called lactase, which is something you add to milk to break down the lactose. And that's where you get lactose-free milk, and you can buy it on the market. It has nothing to do with pasteurization, which is something that there's a big mistake that some people can drink milk that has been pasteurized, or some people have to have raw milk to be able to drink milk. It has nothing to do with lactose. Pasteurization does not destroy lactose. That's a myth. And so anyway, it's interesting to see the comments and commentary that are coming in, and also people just going, well, I never knew I was an Israelite, and that was the whole point of my discussion, to get down to the fact that the Northern Europeans and the Northern Europeans all the way from the Caucasus west and a little bit in northern Spain, and this is going back into historic times way before Christ, when the Israelites were moving around and then moved into the British Isles, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, the three countries of Scandinavia, and then into the English islands, the British, what we now call the British Isles in Ireland and Scotland. Those are the true Israelites, and they do have lactose tolerance, 100%. And it's one of the very telling things about this whole story, just like when I talked on my March 4th, and if you have not seen my or listened to my March 4th lecture, go there, listen to that. That's the beginning of all this, and every week after that, I've had a little segment on this. But in that show, the very importance of Joseph of Arimathea being an Israelite in Old Rome, being the minister of mines, because the Romans could not go to England. Glastonbury was the primary source of metals for copper, for lead, for iron, and that was the primary source. And Joseph of Arimathea, of course, could go there because he was an Israelite. And he worked, he managed the mines, and he managed getting the metal, the crude metal, back to Rome, where it was then formed into swords and armor and trinkets and coins and everything else that you would use in a developing country around, this is around the time of Christ. But the Israelites had held these islands, and I just saw an excellent, excellent documentary on the Romans going into what they called Gaul, or the they called them barbarians in the north. And if you were a Roman, they feared. The Romans didn't fear anybody, let me put it this way. They had annexed pretty much the known world, and they were moving out into regions that were simply unknown, into Asia Minor, into the Middle East, into Turkey. They had annexed Egypt. They had annexed northern Africa. They had conquered Spain up to the Pyrenees, from the south up to the Pyrenees. And they were moving into Europe, into northern Europe. They had conquered what is now Austria. This is all part of the Roman Empire, but they could not penetrate England or Ireland, certainly not Ireland, and certainly not northern Europe, where the Germanic tribes lived. And there's a story about the Roman three legions. This is one-tenth, a full 10% of all of the legions of Rome went into the Black Forest, and they were led by the nephew-in-law of Augustus Caesar. Now, Augustus was the ruler who ruled all of this vast Roman Empire, but they could not penetrate Gaul, the north of the Black Forest. And so he's sent under the direction of his bumbling idiot nephew-in-law. He had this guy had married his niece and therefore got charge of these three legions of Roman soldiers that went into Northern Europe, and they were all killed. They were all just devastated. They went back really decades later only to find tens of hundreds of miles of bones scattered where the native barbarians, as they were called, but Germanic, the Israelites literally, had tricked them into going into one of the worst parts, bog areas of the Black Forest, and just killed them to the last man. And it was many decades later that the Romans finally went back there and found the carnage. But the Romans desperately feared the Germanic tribes, which were the Israelites. The Israelites were not fun people to be around if you were a Roman. So the whole point of Joseph of Arimathea was key to understanding this. And he happened to be the great uncle of Christ. He was Mary, mother of Christ. He was Mary's uncle, one of the richest men in old Rome. And the other issue there was that Christ went with him a lot. He took Christ under his wing from the time he was a young boy in Israel, and they traveled to India, they traveled to Europe, they traveled to Italy, they were in England, in Glastonbury, what is now Glastonbury, England, operating the mines, the shipping. They were in boats, moving the cargo back and forth, and of course Joseph had his library, which was instrumental. And if you look at Christ's teachings, it's very clear that he had access to the old texts. And that's the thing that the Colbran, which is the remnant that we have today of the library of Joseph of Arimathea, is very clear on the old issues regarding comets. And it's very interesting as this history evolved and the remnants of the library of Joseph of Arimathea were kept by the Celts, that when this finally came out, and of course these books were in Latin and classical Greek, so translating them into modern English was not a hard task. Very easy, very, very thorough, very exacting. And when the Colbran in its current form, that big hardbound book, first came out, I was one of the ones that got one of the first copies of it. And they got it to me on purpose because they knew of my fame of being a scientist understanding comets and celestial events. Because when you start out, everything it talks about is celestial events. So, and you understand that in Christ's teachings, this all comes out in the different ways to live, the things that are in the Colbran, and especially about the ancient comets and the comet disasters involving planet Earth. So anyway, I feel like I'm part of history here in reviving that information to you, the public, because like I said before, when my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colbran Connection, came out, it's not a big book, but it had more impact than anything. It talks about secret societies. It opens up electromagnetic propulsion systems. It opens up the issue of Atlantis having atmospheric electricity and using it not only for electrifying their continent, which was in the South China Sea. I also exposed that it was not beyond the Rock of Gibraltar. The Rock of Gibraltar is not the Pillars of Hercules. The entrance into the Sunda Strait through Jakarta in Sumatra, the Pillars of Hercules were Krakatoa and its sister volcano, much of which is missing now. But back in the days of Atlantis, there were two giant columns of smoke that went into the sky, 100,000 feet in the air, and then the lighting from the volcano lit these up. And you could see these hundreds of miles away in the ocean. So all the Phoenician mariners would get there, and they were doing a lot of trading with Atlantis, which was a worldwide empire. The Phoenicians would come in and they talked about the bogs. These were grass bogs that were floating and grew in the ocean, and there were channels cut in. And if you got too close to Atlantis and you were not welcome, of course, all the boats were in those days were sailing. They used wooden boats with cotton sails, hemp or natural material sails. They would burn them right out of the water. So Atlantis was an impenetrable city. It was a five-ring city, and in the very center was the Poseidon, the tower, which was also doubled as the Tesla's tower. In modern day, we would call it Tesla. And that's the connection with Tesla. Tesla understood this. Tesla had access to the Vatican Library through his father, who was the curator of that library in Kosovo, where he grew up. And so anyway, the old texts and documents which indicated how to tap into the vertical electric field of the Earth, that's where Tesla, I guarantee you, got some of his information to start. When Tesla did his experimentation in Colorado Springs, and especially the Wardenclyffe Tower, he did not build a small one, then a next size, and then a next size, and get up to the big one. He built the big one right out of the chute, which is like the Wright brothers building a 747 airliner. That's the equivalent of what Tesla did with the atmospheric electricity. And knowing the frequency, the resonant frequency of the atmosphere, the resonant frequency of the ground, and being able to tap into that. And of course, this happened at the verge of World War I. And of course, that's when air warfare was coming into vogue. And he said with his machine, he could knock airplanes out of the sky, which he could, because by setting up a series of Wardenclyffe towers along the coastline, as airplanes came over, you would just activate those. The discharge would occur where the airplanes were, and boom, you would have no ability to penetrate that shield. And that was Tesla's. I talk about this in my education program, which was originally my paid cast, which has now been converted into the education program. So at any rate, that was Tesla's main. I did some lectures on Tesla's military weapon inventions, and that's one that is never publicized or acknowledged, because they talk about his death ray and other inventions that he had. But this was the one that would prevent any air traffic from coming into across the border. And he tried to sell that to the U.S. military, and they took and shut him down. They shut him down, and they claim it was because they were worried about the Germans getting Tesla's technology, but they were more worried about the public getting this technology and understanding that you could get electricity from the atmosphere, not for free. Nothing is free. Energy is not free. But if you know how to tap into the vertical electric field of Earth, you have an almost infinite source of energy. And of course, I was working on a model of that to do that. And then I realized, no, this is for the world energy consumption that we're dealing with today, the consumption of electricity. It's not a good idea. You could not just put these things everywhere for many, many reasons. You'd be killing birds. You would be devastating the natural environment. Also, you'd be highly subject. You would be connecting your electric grid to this and distribution network into houses. And if you ever had a solar storm, which we don't have enough knowledge of how to predict them, how to understand electrical discharges in outer space, etc., then you would be subject to this, or at minimum, you would be shutting off your ability to collect electricity from these every time a comet came by or was aligned or you had planetary alignments or solar flares. You'd be shutting down your electric grid because of the eventuality of having major electrical discharges coming through the Tesla towers. Anyway, back to Atlantis. Atlantis was an ancient empire which had very good knowledge of atmospheric electricity. I point out in my Atlantis to Tesla book that Atlantis, being in the South China Sea, is in what is known as the South Pacific Anomaly. When NASA goes over that region in a spacecraft, all communications are just blocked. They're blocked by the radio noise in the atmosphere. And the reason is because of the tremendous amount of atmospheric electricity in that region of the world. And so why is that? I talk about that in my Atlantis to Tesla book. But the where Atlantis was, now I use the example in the book, that imagine people like Polynesians living near the ocean and not learning how to swim. The Polynesians were great swimmers. People who lived in New England in the early pioneer days were not good swimmers because the water was cold. And anyway, the example is that if you live in a region that has abundant atmospheric electricity, chances are you're going to learn how to use it, to harness it, to use it for your advantage, etc. And that's what Atlantis did. It was a highly advanced civilization with naturally occurring electricity. They also understood the principle of differential metals, electricity from differential metals. I talk about that in the book, bimetal, the surface potential of metals and the differences between the different types of metals. That's where the original Edison battery came from, was from Atlantis. Not that Edison knew about that, but Tesla, who worked for him, did. Okay, so anyway, a little bit of a sidetrack there talking about my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, a very important book, but that's where the Colburn was introduced to the Western civilizations. And very important in there are the comet disasters that occurred during recorded history. Very important. And the point is that the Israelites were a part of this as they followed Moses out of Egypt. That was one of the major comet events, the Venus event. Okay, so anyway, I got a lot of topics to cover tonight. I just try and insert some of this real history. Now, just ask yourself a question. If you go to grade school, high school, college, university, Harvard University, Oxford University, say you're a Rhodes Scholar, you would never hear that in a classroom in any of these universities, colleges, whatever. You will never, ever hear that, which is the real history of the world. And there's not a single educational institution on the planet that would teach it. Because, first of all, they don't know it, and second of all, that'd be like contrary to their little belief system, which is just so hackedly wrong, you know, that I don't, it's just not even worth going there. Okay, so anyway, I was talking about the volcano in St. Vincent, and these poor people have had their lives disrupted, as has happened on numerous Caribbean islands, living in paradise in a right through Hurricane Alley. These people were affected by hurricanes a number of years ago, etc. Okay, I want to talk about my comment on Netflix. I read it on air last week, and it was about on YouTube. It was a Netflix video documentary on water, the world's water crisis, it was called, and I put in a commentary, and of course, YouTube took it down immediately. So then a fan picked it up and copied it and put it in again. And then magically mine reappeared, which was very interesting. So and they were gaslighting me, and which means that I could see my comment, but nobody else could. My comment is back up again, which is interesting. And that of the my exact same comment, mouse copied, and I think the blogger name there is JW. I think that's JW is a person that has followed my work for years and saw fit to put it up there. Okay, but last week I talked about this horrifically bad Netflix video that's on YouTube talking just total disinformation about the world water shortage. And sure, there are water problems in the world, but they're mainly man-created. Bad management. But I will say that there was a good YouTube video that I saw. Actually, I would classify it as excellent. It is called, the title of it is Can Seawater, two words, seawater, Can Seawater Desalination Save the World? It was done in October of 2019, and very excellent. What I've done is, because of my understanding of weather and all of the related issues and how to create weather, I've devised a system that could be very easily implemented, and using my wing generator as an energy source to provide water to just literally any part in the world, any place in the world, especially desert areas. And so the trick to reverse desertification, which the world is still creating desert at a tremendous breakneck pace, the trick to it is providing water, because in an extended drought, the seeds even die off. They try to grow, they get a little bit of spurt of water, and they try and grow, and then they don't, so that destroys the seed. And so they just can't reproduce, and you end up with this desert. And a lot of it, the Sahara Desert, is because the Roman armies went in there and cut down all the trees for their ships. The Romans had vast navies, and their opponents had vast navies. And you go back to the Greeks, they were all cutting and cutting and cutting, and the end result was the Sahara Desert, where they just cut everything down. It was in a tropical region that they did not bring in sufficient rain, and once the forests were gone, the heat rising up off the desert is so strong the clouds can't form, and it'll never regrow again, unless you do something innovative. Anyway, once again, the issue with water in the world, and yes, there are big cities, they have water issues, and they can be solved. They are solvable. There are ways to deal with the water issues. You know, and let me just kind of summarize this a little bit. People elect politicians. Most politicians have maybe a third grade functional scientific or mathematics ability. They're people that learn to talk their way through life without really knowing much. So when it comes to things like, say, water, which requires mathematical analysis, it requires really understanding the issues, understanding solutions that are available, and being creative and implementing those. And then also where the politicians might come in is convincing people that, hey, you have to get rid of your flush toilet. And they go, what do you mean, my flush toilet? I mean, I love my flush toilet. I can't live without it. Well, no, you can live without your flush toilet. People all over the world do it all the time. In Scandinavian countries, they don't have a lot of water, and they don't have a lot of drainage where you can get rid of the waste. And so they have used dry toilets for a long time, solving the water problem. And once you get a big city, then your water use starts to really become a problem, because it's not just the water use, it's the wastewater. And like I said in my little write-up on the Netflix thing, imagine a flush toilet. You take a little bit of poop and pee, mix it with 3 to 5 gallons of water, then that water goes down the drain with all of your other water, which goes to the processing plant. So now all of a sudden you have tens of thousands of gallons of water that's polluted. And this never really had to happen. And because when you dry out in a composting toilet, when the poop dries out, which is the bad part, the liquid part, the pee part, is not that dangerous. But the solid part is. That's where the bacteria grow. That's where the bad, the things that grow on that can be very bad for you, cycling back the things that can grow on that are very bad for you. But if you dry it out and break it down, biologically, it's very easy to break that down. Now, all of a sudden, you have very rich fertilizer that is bacteria-free. The bacteria that's bad for humans cannot grow on that. So you cannot use raw human sewage as fertilizer, but you can use composted, dried, broken down. And how do you do that? Well, it's very easy. You use natural materials like moss, and this could become an industry, growing moss for dry toilets, and other materials that you can use. And then all of a sudden, this becomes a fertilizer which you can put on the ground and fertilize the ground. Now, all of a sudden, instead of becoming a toxic sludge, it becomes a very useful byproduct. And if you look at the central United States, for example, pull up this list on a Google map. Depleted land in the world. Just type that into, a Google search or your favorite web browser search. And look for the depleted land. And oddly enough, the entire central United States, what we typically call our breadbasket, is some of the most depleted land in the world. When it started, when the sod busters first went out and broke ground in Kansas and Nebraska and in the plains, when they first broke the ground, it was very deep, rich soil. And over the decades and decades and decades of open farming, where you plow the land, soil has just been washed away to the where there's no nutrients left. In the same, let's say, place like, say, Ohio, which was forest, hardwood forest typically, cut down a tree, plant the crops, etc., between the tree stumps. Eventually the tree stumps rot away, and then eventually the rain comes and washes all the topsoil away. So then you're left with Monsanto-style farming, where you're putting ammonia fertilizers in the ground to make these plants that look real nice, but they have no food value at all, and they're hybrid. They can only grow in a toxic sludge of fertilizers, and then the weeds that try and grow there, they kill those off using another chemical that the corn or the soybeans are resistant to because they've genetically been modified. That's the current state of agriculture. But the situation in terms of water, imagine if you could take all of this fertilizer from human waste, take it out to those regions and revitalize the land. There are people growing corn. And by the way, just since I mentioned the word corn, if you have heard of anybody or if you had purchased the corn that I sold 10 years ago, or anybody who's dealing with, say, organic non-GMO corn growth, seeds or seed saving or any of those things, get a hold of me. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Send in an email. There's a contact email there for the webpage. And just send me information as to what you have. But back to the idea of corn, that we could be growing organic, non-GMO corn as the base crop for everything, and it would be excellent. And that we could grow it on a very large scale without all the chemicals, etc. There are countries, I can name off a few, Bolivia, Peru, that don't allow any GMO. Poland is another one. The GMO has been outlawed. Monsanto has been outlawed. And you can do it, but these people have just taken over the United States, where cash is king. You pay off a politician, you get your way. That's the way the United States runs. So the big corporations have just had a field day in the United States, getting away with pollution and poisoning the public for profit. That's what I call the EPA, is the Environmental Poisoning Agent or Environmental Pollution Agency. It's not the Environmental Protection Agency. They sell licensing to pollute. That's what they do. This is exactly what they do. So anyway, let me get back to this video I was talking about, which is a good video. Can seawater desalination save the world? And it turns out that desalination, which is one of the items in my product line, powered from the wing generator, is a pretty good idea, but they make a very good explanation in this movie that the sludge that results from the desalination process is a problem. It's very high salt content, But then, you know, the thing is, you have to have a desalination plant. It also is a processing plant for the fresh water. And so what happens is you desalinate the water, you mix it with any locally available fresh water that you have. Then when the wastewater comes back, you put that in the same stream as the sludge water, the desalinated sludge water from the desal process, and you send it into the ocean. And as long as you have cleaned up that water to where it's literally just like rainwater, you mix it with the sludge. Now you're not sending this sludge into the oceans to offset the marine life, etc. So anyway, that's a solvable issue, but still, reverse osmosis is a very energetic, energy-intensive process. And there again, that's where the wing generator comes in, because now you're getting the energy, 95% of it, from the wind. So you have a process that once you have set it up, you've set up the initial equipment, the wing generation, the reverse osmosis plant, one and the all of the equipment, the peripheral equipment, the pumps and the valves, etc. Once you've set that up, now all of a sudden, the price of the water goes way down because your energy source is the wind. That makes a lot of sense. And of course, it's not going to work with solar. It's not going to work with three-blade wind turbines, because three-blade wind turbines don't work. Solar only works a couple hours of the day. So what are you going to do the rest of the day? Have all of that expensive equipment shut down? No. And so anyway, the only solution is the wing generator and using desalination on a much larger scale. I forget the plant in California, I think it's by San Diego. There's another big one down in Tampa that produce millions and millions of gallons of fresh water per day from desalinization. But I have another method which is potentially easier than both of those. And the thing about desalination is when the fresh water leaves the desal plant, it's in a tube. It's going out into a infrastructure of water delivery. My method, it comes in as a broad, as rainwater. And so therefore, is a much better solution, because now you can green the land and develop that process to where it's going to rain again. Once you have desertification, the land absorbs the sunlight, it reflects that sunlight up into the air, the clouds don't form and it doesn't rain. So you have to reverse that process, you have to start it raining again to get that area green, and so then that vegetation absorbs the sunlight and reduces the amount of heat rising off the land during the daytime, and all of a sudden you start accumulating underground water again because it starts to rain. And so with the rain, you have a lot more water than and a lot less energy with my process than it takes to do desalination. Okay. This is a topic coming up that I talked about on two shows. Actually, yesterday I was on the John Moore Show in the morning, and then I was on the Power Hour with Daniel Brigman at midday. That's my monthly appearance on that show. Of course, I'm with John Moore every Wednesday morning, his second hour. And interestingly enough, I brought up, John goes, what's on your radar today? And that's military, by the way, secret military for what are you thinking? So anyway, I understand that. There's a coming false flag. And John goes, that's interesting. That's what I talked about on my first hour. And he's been predicting the exact same thing, certainly coming from probably a different informational standpoint than I have. So anyway, what I did is I outlined some of the, what I call the short list of potential false flag events that they could pull. And the one that they've been priming the pump on most of all is an alien invasion, oddly enough. And that's what Wernher von Braun was talking about, a false flag alien invasion as a way of taking over a country, or in fact, the entire world. And so I would rank that high on my list of false flag events to come in the very near future, potentially yet this spring. And then, or an asteroid or meteorite shower, they've been priming the pump on that one regularly. Weather, that's another one that's been having its pump primed news-wise to get the public conditioned. Volcanic eruption or earthquake, that's another one that can be man-made, man-manipulated, or a solar flare. And I would put my hat squarely on solar flare as probably being the biggest possibility, the greatest possibility of a false flag event, which would then trigger weather events, would be over here, then over there, and oh my goodness, now it's in a community near you. And the ultimate effect of all of this, any of these, would be to bring down the power grid, bring down the electricity in your area. And I mentioned that in Texas, that was a dry run. That was a getting all the communications in order, getting all the government agencies communicating back and forth, getting the governor to react at the right time to send in troops, you know, and on and on and on. And that was one of the funny but not funny things about the Texas power outage is the governor called in the National Guard. What is the National Guard going to do? Walk around and, you know, I mean, absolutely absurd. But they brought him in to kind of normalize the idea that if there's a power outage, you should call the National Guard. I mean, literally, what are they going to do? Nothing. They have no ability to bring back the power. They're not specialized in electrical grid, resurgence or anything else. So why bring in the National Guard if it's not for a preparatory step to condition the people that, you know, the governor, to make it look like he's doing something, calls in the National Guard? But the point of this false flag event, which I predict is coming, will be a tremendous amount of social unrest and rioting in the streets. It'll affect all aspects of life, including food, water, energy, transportation, telecom, internet, construction, police and personal protection, military, and the list goes on and on. Anything that happens, your ability to drive down a road, and this whole COVID thing was conditioning people also to listen to the news, to do what they tell you, stay in your homes, don't object, don't bring up any negative or contradictory information. You are not allowed to speak and expose the drama that's going on for what it is, strictly drama. So anyway, that is what appears to be on the horizon. Okay, so I'm not going to say any more about that other than be prepared. And also, I commented more extensively on the Power Hour yesterday about the youth of the country, of the United States, being basically babes being sent to the front lines of a military event because they have no idea what's going on. They have no idea of history. They think they know something because they learned it in a book in school, but all that's 99% garbage. Okay, so at any rate, very interesting times we're heading into here. And I predicted also this would be early in the Biden presidency, commensurate with the George Bush Jr. being the 9/11 event being eight months into his presidency when 9/11 happened. And, of course, that was an event that changed the world in the course of human endeavor. Okay, NASA has released a study saying that oxygen, molecular oxygen, that's O2, on the Earth was not around until a certain number of, what they say, 2.5 billion years ago. The problem with NASA talking about atmosphere or anything to do with atmosphere is they can't tell you where it came from in the first place. How did this amazing planetary atmosphere get onto planet Earth? Because here's the problem. When they talk about the formation of the solar system, they talk about this material, dust and gases colliding to form the planet. So these are coming in at hypervelocity speeds, and when they hit, any volatiles that might be in this, either in the earth or in the object that's coming in, the meteorite or the rock or the stone or whatever, the energy that's coming in would cause this to melt. It's enough energy to cause the entire planet to melt. So they, and without an atmosphere, there's nothing to hold anything there in terms of volatiles. So these escape and they go away. So the end result is that you start out with a planet with no atmosphere, molten hot and no atmosphere. And of course, we see Venus today with a fully blown atmosphere, thousands of times larger than the atmosphere of Earth, and it's a brand new planet. That's the reality. And of course, NASA is trying to figure out how it got all this atmosphere and how it kept it there, in spite of the fact that it has so-called greenhouse effect. Anyway, none of it makes any sense at all. But the point is that in this collision process where they say the planets formed allegedly 4.5 billion years ago, there's no way to have an atmosphere when this process is done. So they just kind of skip over this, where did the atmosphere come in the first place? And then the second issue is that they claim that the Earth's atmosphere and all the gases were somehow contained from the very beginning. They don't allow for any contribution coming in afterwards. For a while, they were saying that, oh, comets brought the water in, meaning the water in the ocean. Well, what about the salts? What about all of the other chemicals that are in the atmosphere? The nitrogen, which is a major component of our atmosphere. It's a relatively neutral gas, doesn't react well with anything else. So where did all this nitrogen come from? And they're trying to tell you that the oxygen came when this little microbe converted other gases, more complex gases, and released O2. and then they talk about there being ice ages on planet Earth, where the entire planet was encrusted in ice during certain times of its history. But there's really no coherent story here, but the overriding theme is that all of these gases were there from the very beginning. Well, they weren't there from the very beginning. They just kind of gloss over that. Where did the atmosphere come in the beginning? Well, of course, they don't answer that because they don't know. They don't even bring it up. It's not a question on their lips. Okay, so the end result is that the Earth has had its atmosphere completely changed and altered many times because of comets passing by. And Earth would become involved in either a Mars-type event where the atmosphere was completely stripped of the planet at a single time, and so the oceans and the atmosphere were completely removed by a large passing comet. And then it started to build up over time and rejuvenate because of the Earth itself being a comet, attracting the materials in the zone where we move through the solar system every year. But the changing of Earth's atmosphere has happened many, many times. So very important to understand that. And that, for example, the end of the life of the dinosaurs, when the majority of dinosaurs died off, was due to ongoing cometary activity. And it could have been something as simple as changing the atmosphere that the dinosaurs lived in. That if you go by today's standard atmosphere, then was that the same atmosphere that the dinosaurs encountered? Is that the same atmosphere that the mastodons and the woolly mammoths and the saber-toothed tiger, was that the same atmosphere they were breathing? You know, and there again, that's one of the problems with carbon dating, is that the assumption is that the atmosphere has been the same through all of these epochs, and that really is not a valid assumption. So, at any rate, what is the true history of Earth's atmosphere? The true history is that it has changed many times. When the dinosaurs were around millions of years ago, they had vast vegetation on a worldwide scale. And the issue is that today, if you took a dinosaur, say a dino-type dinosaur, the one with the great big one with the long neck, they were vegetarians. The, of course, the Tyrannosaurus rex, the one we usually associate with Jurassic Park or whatever, they were carnivores. They ate meat. But the big plant-eating dinosaurs consumed a tremendous amount of vegetation every day. So on Earth, if you had a dinosaur today and you tried to find a place on Earth to put that dinosaur so that he would have plenty of food, you couldn't find one. You really couldn't find one. And so you might think, well, what about the Amazon jungle? There might be sufficient there to support a few dinosaurs, but the Earth had tremendous fields of dinosaurs. The entire planet was covered with dinosaurs, and the point is that the carbon dioxide level was much higher. So that it had this abundant growth, a very different climate, and a very different atmospheric content makeup. In other words, the chemical composition of the atmosphere was very different. And so many times throughout the history of the planet Earth, it has seen major changes in its atmosphere, but the Earth doesn't just jump up and down and do this by itself, and that's the main point. NASA and the related standard scientists are always looking for a way for Earth to do this, to resolve this data, all by itself. And the Earth does not have the ability to make these major changes all by itself. There were probably 20 periods of major mountain building in the history of the Earth. So that's when major cometary activity happened. And some of these could have been very large comets. In fact, some of them were very large comets. But then there's the physical size of the nucleus. That's one aspect of looking at the size of a comet. And then the coma. How long did Earth spend in that coma, interacting with all the gases and et cetera that are in the coma of the comet and changing and altering our atmosphere, et cetera? And was the Earth protected? Were there still electrical discharges that gave Earth a shield? Or was the Earth acting as a comet nucleus where it was drawing in all of this material? So all of these are factors, but the end result is that large comets passing by Earth have changed the atmosphere on many different occasions. Many different occasions. And it's reflected in the development of plant and animal life subsequent and, of course, prior to and subsequent to these major events. Last week, was it, or 2 weeks ago, I announced that I had a new webpage. And I did. But I had to switch away from it almost immediately because the developers there were a lot of problems with the page. People couldn't get to certain subpages. Some of the other information that was accessible was simply not there. So it didn't take me long to figure out that the webpage that had been developed could not replace my webpage as it is now. So I'm back to the old webpage. And I'll tell you, I've had this webpage for literally decades now. The core is still there. The shell HTML code and everything is still there. I'm going to try and get this updated because I want to enter the 20th century at least, or the 21st century, I guess. And it still seems to be very difficult to get developers to actually do their job and notice everything that has to be put in there. My webpage has over 9 gigabytes worth of information, maybe more than 10 now. I think it's broken 10 gigabytes of information. So that is a lot to keep track of, and it has to all be there. I'm back to my old webpage and the one that you're familiar with. But until we get this other web page fixed up properly to cut over, I'll be still using the old web page. Okay, just a quick notice also, and I notice whenever I'm on John Moore's show or Daniel Brigman with Power Hour or whatever, they always ask about supporting them. And so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but the things that I offer on my webpage are very unique. They're very important. Energy, water, educational material. I encourage you to look at the educational material I have on my webpage, things that you're not going to find anyplace else. And then also, so the water filters are still on sale. And the generators, have people that are buying simply the generators or the wing generator for backup power. And then there's also the multi-blade wind generators for the small off-grid home systems, as opposed to the wing generator, which is more industrial level equipment, etc. So go to my webpage, the URL, the short URL, jmccsci.com. And people always ask me, what should they do? Yesterday, I was on, I think it was John Moore's show, a woman called in and she asked about a particular location, doesn't matter where. Is that a good place to move to? Is that a safe place? And I encourage you to do your own research on this. I don't make recommendations myself because I cannot tell you where you're going to be happy or what's going to work for you. I have my own ideas of what might be a good idea, but that might be not right for you. And I commented that I think she was asking about Idaho. Well, that's fine if you're used to cold weather. You know how to live in cold weather. You have to know how to live, say, off-grid in cold weather, which is a whole trick in itself. So my answer is that I don't recommend to people where they should move to. That's the last thing I would start doing. But the one thing I did say is if you do go someplace or if you start planning to go offline, go off-grid, or anything like that, that you be very careful about the people you select to go with you. Because some people don't have any concept of what it would take. The example I used was that some people want a three-course meal for breakfast, dinner, and supper. And if you're just dealing with limited food supply, that isn't going to happen. So you'd have some people that would eat all your food up in the first week, and then you would have nothing. So how do you find these people? How do you find people that are good and will be good in a crisis situation? I don't know. The fewer people, the better. That's all I can tell you. And a lot of times you think, well, this person has really done a lot of camping. They really know their stuff about being outdoors, etc. When in fact, they might be the worst person to have around. And then the person you think least is going to help is going to be the one that helps the most. So I think you have to, like, just like with equipment, you have to test the waters and see who works, see what works, and do a little practice. And because there might come a time very soon when you're not going to have electricity, you're not going to have the ability to take care of yourself in the normal traditional ways. Okay, well, I'm about out of time here. Once again, remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.